Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Totally soaked and certain I would die as I desperately clung to a piece of driftwood, alone in a raging sea while the vessel I'd booked passage on slid to a watery grave, I couldn't help but consider that there was very little upside in playing games of chance with creatures of pure, unremitting evil. I'm not certain if that particular bit of advice will be of much general utility. It certainly lacks the universal appeal of cautions against going out of one's way to annoy magic users, or the hazards of involving oneself in the affairs of such beings. In point of fact, I had no idea when I sat down at a gaming table in the bowels of the good ship Lop that I would find myself, barely an hour later, the sole survivor of the poor vessel's explosive and disastrous end. On the other hand, if one had sat me down and told me that such events were about to transpire, I can't say as I would have been all that surprised.
Graphic Audio presents So Apropos of Nothing, Book 3, Tong Lashing, by Peter David. Narrated by Scott McCormick. With performances by Yasmin Toison, Chris Davenport, Kimberly Gilbert, Colleen Delaney, Bradley Smith, Terence Azelford, Tony Nam, Scott Graham, Joe Brack, James Konacek, Al Twanmo, Eric Singh Dolson, Eva Wilhelm, Patrick Busick, Nick DePinto, Danny Gavigan, Marnie Penny, Helen Parfumi, Nora Ashwati, Drew Kobus, Christopher Graybill, Steve Wanal, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Ken Jackson, Casey Platt, and Mort Shelby. So Apropos of Nothing, Book 3, Tongue Lashing.
I bear the unlikely name of Apropos, a moniker given to me by a long-dead tavern wench of a mother. I was spawned as the result of her gang rape by a group of knights. As a consequence, I have an understandably jaded view of the world. Curiously, this did not prevent my brief tenure as Sir Apropos of Nothing in the court of Good King Runcible, and my even briefer status as future royal son-in-law. That business came to a fairly disastrous end, and after further misadventures, I wound up fleeing the state of Asteria altogether, in the company of a magic user named Cherie. Odd, I thought we'd wind up together. As I write about my life, with the comfortable distance of years between my foolish youth and my positively imbecilic old age, I have come to realize that not only did I expect our union would be the case, but I'm disappointed it didn't turn out that way. I think my life would have been much better had it happened. I thought Cherie and I would become a couple. I have no idea whether that meant we would have grown old together, indulged each other's foibles and growing infirmities together, become progressively sick of each other and yet remain together out of a sense of mindless devotion, stale affection, or perhaps simply inertia. Yes, well, even my nostalgia tends to find itself devolving towards unpleasantries. When presented with the question of whether a glass is half full or half empty, I instead dwell on why there wasn't enough liquid available to fill it up in the first place. Still, Cherie was quite something. A weather weaver she was, capable of manipulating weather threads in a most expert and occasionally lethal fashion. With black hair and flashing gray eyes, Cherie floated in and out of my life like a butterfly with razor-sharp wings. Our longest separation, up until the time when she left me prior to this narrative, occurred when I was a victim of a sort of temporary memory loss and had become a ruthless warlord, or peace lord as I called myself, in an unforgiving land called Wuin. Cherie was one of a group of insurrectionists who sought to put an end to my career through the expedient means of putting an end to me. This plan ran aground when my invincibility was revealed to all and sundry, and from that point on, nothing and no one was capable of stopping me. Except someone did. I won't go into detail about it at this point, for the tale was already told once, and I see no reason to cover the gruesome details a second time. Suffice to say that, as it is not uncommon in my varied and sordid adventures, a goodly number of people died, and there was much collateral carnage and mayhem. The grisly business concluded, it was a rather odd trio who set out across the land of Wuin, hoping to leave the destruction behind us, along with a devastating talisman of extraordinary chaos. But I wanted nothing to do with it, despite the fact that it gave me almost limitless power. I think in an odd way that my decision made me more attractive to Shuri. Certainly after the incident with the gem, the Eye of the Beholder as it was called, she treated me in a marginally more kindly fashion. She kept her ready tongue and sharp sense of humor, but when she turned her sword-like wit upon me, it was to poke gently rather than to stab. Likewise, the barbs that I had once hurled at her were no longer coated with the venom that had used to adorn them. Plus, our new spirit of cooperation might have been aided by the third member of our most unusual trio. That third member was a drabbit, a small feathered dragon-like creature that had taken to me during my incarceration as Peace Lord. The name I'd given him, or perhaps he'd always possessed, was Mordant. He didn't speak, naturally, since he was simply a dumb animal, although I would oftentimes find it disconcerting that he looked at me with a sort of cold, calculating intelligence. At such times, he had an almost human look to him, except I suspected he was considerably smarter than most humans I'd encountered in my lifetime. In my dreams, he would speak to me, making lacerating observations about me or the various choices I made in my existence. In real life, however, he remained mute. All preconceptions for Morden, however, were eradicated when, at one point in our sojourn through Wuin, he had opened his mouth and spoken with pure, clear diction. We stood there on a desolate piece of land that really wasn't all that different from the rest of the desolation. Flat, unyielding terrain, tufts of small bits of green giving their all to survive, and most likely losing that all. High, high above us, carrion eaters circled lazily. I endeavored to ignore them. I figured that looking at them would only encourage them.
Bloody well right, I'll deny it. You've got to start thinking for yourself and stop ascribing everything in your life to me.
Do I have to do that, Mordant?
Absolutely.
As you can well imagine, we stared at him, thunderstruck. For long moments, it seemed as if the world had stopped turning. Shuri's horse even backed up, looking concerned over the fact that the animal nearby had suddenly begun speaking. I wondered wildly if the horse was going to start conversing as well, perhaps say something such as,
"Shut up, you fool. They're not supposed to know we can speak. You'll ruin it for all of us."
I had never encountered an animal capable of speech before.
Did you just speak?
What do you think?
That's it. I'm dreaming. Ow! You pinched me. What did you do that for?
To prove to you that you're not dreaming.
I was willing to figure that out for myself.
I could bite you in case there's any doubt.
Not necessary. Shuri, are you doing this somehow? Some sort of weaver's trick, projecting your voice in some manner?
Would you be satisfied if I drank a mug of water while he spoke? Most intriguing. Your voice is strangely accented.
So is yours.
Who cares about his accent? He's a blasted talking animal.
So are you.
I had no immediate response to that, which was annoying in and of itself. Bad enough to find oneself lagging behind in an oral battle of wits with an accomplished human opponent. Being bested by a creature who, for all I knew, hadn't truly began vocalizing until a minute or so earlier was a new low in personal esteem.
Why haven't you spoken before this? Openly, I mean.
Because you're interesting.
I am.
Yes, you are. And you know he is, so don't pretend otherwise. You're a lost soul apropos of nothing. And I think you're only just now starting to realize it. But you're not sure yet what to do about it. It was entertaining to hear you go on and on about whatever deep emotional conflicts were shredding you. But the only reason you would vent your spleen in my presence was because you didn't really think I could understand you. You might have suspected it at some level, but you did not truly believe it. So on and on you would talk, and it was all rather riveting. You should think about writing it all down.
It was the very first time anyone, or anything for that matter, had ever suggested that I chronicle my adventures. My immediate reaction was to dismiss the concept out of hand. I thought, who in the hell would be so foolish as to want to spend time involving themselves in the tortured, horrific joke that is my life? And now, having set down my escapades in 2 volumes so far, with this being the third, I find that I've come no closer to being able to answer that question than I ever had.
I've often told Apropos he had potential, that he had a destiny. He never seemed to believe it, though.
I couldn't. Despite the fact that my late mother had said much the same thing, it was a notion I had traditionally rejected, and then later fought against with every fiber of my being. I firmly believed that destiny was an excuse given after the fact by people who were losers seeking a way of rationalizing all the disappointments that were their life. Lately, though, I have begun to wonder. The concept of free will versus what the gods have in store for us have received a good deal of play in my life. Furthermore, I found myself considering the fact that most men live their lives in quiet desperation. Desperation being the single largest city in all the world, and reputedly the most staggeringly boring, hence the quiet appellation. Situated west of the state of Hysteria, quiet desperation was the capital of the state of Grace, named for the founder's wife, whose name was curiously Margaret. People flocked there because of the easy living and usually balmy weather. And those who didn't live in quiet desperation often aspired to live long enough to earn enough money to move there. I found myself comparing myself to those who lived in quiet desperation and considered that they truly were destiny-free, because their lives were so damn dull.
Why now? Why did you suddenly start making it obvious to me now that you could speak?
Because she's here, which means it's unlikely that you'll be forthcoming about yourself anymore. So I felt I might as well join future conversations. Although, frankly, I doubt you'll enjoy hearing anyone converse as much as you enjoy hearing yourself.
That's reasonably accurate.
My famed glare had little effect on her, and unfortunately did not reduce her to the puddle of goo I was hoping it would. We made our way then across the land of Wuin. When we happened to come upon other travelers, Mordant would fall silent so as not to garner further questions from startled passers-by. We encountered one or two threats, but it was nothing that a healthy running away couldn't handle. The greatest challenge we encountered was trying to steer clear of cities or towns that had known the ravages of my army during my time as Peace Lord. Eventually, however, matters took an unexpected turn. We made our way much farther north than even my peregrinations as the Peace Lord had taken me. As a consequence, we were able to enter with impunity a particularly sizable port city, Port Debris, renowned for having the largest single dock in the entire land, known as the Grand Jetty. Since it was a major port, few people were really paying attention to the faces that passed by in the crowds. That suited us just fine. It also seemed wiser to keep Morden out of sight, since there might be some who would associate the Drabbit with the once formidable Peace Lord. We needn't have worried, however. Morden assured us that he wouldn't be seen if he didn't want to be, and he was absolutely true to his word. As we made our way through the many tents and similar ramshackle structures of Port Debris, I would occasionally spot Morden flitting from one hiding place to another, but the only reason I saw him was because I knew he was there. It was our intention to try and get the hell out of Wuin while the getting was good. The land certainly had nothing more to offer me. Nor did Cherie have any particular interest in staying. As a weather weaver, she tended to have more luck with her spells in a climate that wasn't as relentlessly arid, and Morden hadn't stated any preference one way or the other. We wound up at a busy pub in the heart of Port Debris. We'd learned that it was an excellent place to find ships and ship captains with whom we could book passage. We were not exactly destitute. I had reluctantly left behind a small fortune in gems, but I had had access to a significant number of dead bodies, which we dutifully torched before setting out on our expedition, and I'd taken the liberty of relieving quite a few of them of whatever monies they had upon them. Cherie and I went in 2 different directions, asking around, seeing what we could find. Fortunately, I was and am a reasonably good judge of character. I was certain that at least 2 of the men I spoke to are actually of the most villainous nature. Who would have been quite pleased to take us as passengers and, during the night, relieve us of our valuables and our lives before tossing us over the side to a watery grave. What I wound up doing was seeking out people who seemed as if they were having trouble walking. Sure enough, I found a small group of folks who looked a bit shaky on their feet for exactly the reason I expected they would. They'd been at sea and had just recently come off a ship. Their general deportment, because they're decidedly non-nautical suitcases, told me that they were travelers rather than crewmen. If one wanted to be sure that a ship would see you safely to your destination, my reasoning was to seek out recommendations from people who had already made it from whatever port of call they'd just been to here. Inquiring of the new arrivals, I learned that they'd been brought over on a ship commanded by one Captain Stout. A worthy and hardy-sounding name, I had to admit. As it so happened, I found the good captain tossing back some mead in the corner of the bar. Large, gruff, and affable, he struck me as a solid seaman, and his disposition certainly matched the glowing reports I'd received from his recent passengers. I had no place in particular I was planning to go, which, as it turned out, dovetailed with Captain Stout's agenda. He had a cargo he was transporting to an island continent called Azure. Azure was, by all accounts, a decent enough place, albeit a bit colder than I was used to. But I believed I could get accustomed to it. And besides, it wasn't as if we'd be staying there permanently. If we liked it, we could. But if not, we could always find somewhere else. It was at that moment that I abruptly realized I was thinking of Cherie and I as a we. I had to remind myself that Mordred was part of the mix. But on some level, I was starting to regard Cherie and I as a pair. The thought was staggering to me. And yet, as the first waves of shock subsided, I slowly realized that it was not an unpleasant notion. I began to wonder if she felt the same way and decided that she very likely did. After all, I reasoned, I had to be getting the notion from somewhere. And where else could it reasonably have been coming from, if not from hints or subtle suggestions from Cherie herself? And they would have to have been subtle, because she was a magic user, and that's simply how magic users tended to do things.
What say you, lad? Any interest in heading to the Azure Island? Quite lovely this time of year, I understand. And we'll have a few other passengers aboard, so you have some company other than just my crew.
It sounds fine to me, Captain Stout. Let me check with my friend, and I'll be right back with you. She's just around the other side of the pub.
She? Lady friend? Ladies on sailing vessels aren't always a good mix, me lad. Sailing ships are crewed by rough, battle-hearted seamen. You know what you get when you put women together with seamen?
Pregnancies?
You get bad luck. Now I'm an open-minded man. And I'll bring your little lady along if I must. But just keep her away from my crew. Pray to the water gods for good weather.
Oh, well, we can guarantee that. She's
and ideally that no damned or accursed magic-using weavers come anywhere near my ship.
Weavers are a problem.
You get magic users on your boat and you're guaranteed disaster. How can you guarantee good weather? She's a what?
An amateur weather predictor. Charts storms and such. And she told me there's going to be nothing but good weather and smooth sailing for the next 3 weeks.
Good weather and smooth sailing where?
Everywhere in the world. It's the damnedest thing. Never seen anything like it.
If that's what your woman thinks, then the odds are that she's going to remain an amateur for a very, very long time.
Then he clapped me on the shoulder as if we were old mates.
Ah, now bring your lady friend over here so I can inspect the cut of her jib.
Personally, I didn't think Cherie was going to want the old salt inspecting any cuts of her at all. But I smiled affably and went off to find her. I headed around to the other side of the pub and then stopped. There was Cherie, but she was going out a side door in the company of three rather large men. I gripped my walking staff tightly. The staff was an exceptionally formidable weapon. They had been assisting me in and out of scrapes for over half my life. There was a carving of a lion wrestling a dragon on one end, and a sharp blade could be triggered to snap out of the dragon's mouth to use in combat. In addition, with a twist, the staff could be separated into two halves, and each used as a devastating cudgel. Not that I was anxious to get into any sort of fight. I never was. Then again, I was hoping I wouldn't have to. If I followed Shuri outside and matters appeared dire, I could whistle for Morton, and he would emerge from hiding and rip the throats out of these likely felons in no time at all. While I would stand by and check over their corpses for valuables, it all seemed a very credible plan to me. I couldn't tell if the three men were forcing Shuri to go out with them. All I knew was that they were gone, and I was going to follow them. I moved quickly, stepping through the door, into what turned out to be an alleyway alongside the pub. What I saw astounded me. Shuri had her arm extended, and Mordant was sitting perched upon it. She had a cape coiled around her forearm to protect it from his rather formidable claws. The three men were staring in admiration at Mordant, and the largest of them, a broad-shouldered mustache man wearing a large gray cloak and a white tunic, was even scratching Mordant under the chin.
What the hell is all this?
One of them reached to his side, and I heard the unmistakable hiss of steel against leather as he prepared to draw a sword. This didn't sit particularly well with me, as the prospect of fighting generally didn't, but I was just annoyed enough not to back down. Furthermore, the weight of the bastard sword I kept strapped to my back was of comfort. But Shuri put out her hand to the sword puller.
It's all right. This is apropos. Apropos, these are old friends of mine.
Are they? Imagine running into them here.
This gentleman with the fine moustaches is Rex Regis. He's a weaver. We received a training in the same guild hall years ago.
Little Shuri always had a crush on me.
You had a crush on me.
I feel the need to disagree.
And I feel the need to impale myself. But sometimes we resist urges.
I didn't like the way she was looking at Regis. Nor did I like the way he was looking at her. There was something decidedly unsavory about the whole thing. And I couldn't help but feel that the sooner we were quit of them, the better.
We were just admiring your drabbit. Quite an amazing creature. We can use him on our quest.
I had been about to launch on a truly sterling string of snide remarks and cutting insults that would have been among the most memorable ever put forward in the history of condescending discourse. But Rex's comment tossed it right out of my head.
Quest.
They're on a quest. Doesn't that sound exciting?
Yes, it certainly does. And I have to emphasize here to the concept of sounds, as in is best appreciated second or third hand in the telling of it, rather than the first hand experiencing of it.
Oh, come now. A man of your obvious quality and sophistication would certainly thrive on a good quest.
I glanced over my shoulder to see just who he might be addressing, and then realized with dawning disbelief that he was talking to me.
What's obvious to you appears to have slipped right past me.
Apropos, this is no time to be difficult. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Here's the thing about once-in-a-lifetime opportunities. They tend to shorten the actual lifetime in question.
I think he's a coward. A foul character trait to have.
I prefer to think of it as an alternative lifestyle.
Apropos, listen. What they seek, it's the mystic tome of...
I don't care.
It can transform
anything. I don't care. Shuri, what's...
I quickly put an arm around her shoulders and pulled her a few feet away from the others. Mordant on her arm was rudely jostled by the sudden movement, but managed to hold on nevertheless.
What's going on here? We had plans.
We did?
Yes, we were going to...
Apropos, we hadn't really planned where we were going. We just decided we were getting out of here. But plans aren't about what you're running from. They're about what you're running to.
We're going to Asia. It's all arranged.
It is?
Yes, booked in everything. All set. Let's go.
And what's on Asia?
It doesn't matter.
It does. Apropos, I thought you understood.
Understood what?
Port Deborah isn't just a place of comings and goings. It's a place of opportunities, to find possibilities, to explore. Rex's quest is an incredible possibility. He's leading a group to one of the most challenging...
Shuri, life doesn't have to be about finding challenges. Life is challenge, and I...
You what?
And I want to meet those challenges with you. It's taking me this long to realize that the reason you make me so crazy, so infuriated, is because I have incredibly strong feelings for you. because lately you've been all I think about, which is incredibly amazing, considering that for as far back as I can remember, I've been all I can think about. And even a life of supposed boredom would be devoutly to be desired, because no life with you could ever be boring. You're everything I need, everything I could want. I feel as if I'd suffocate without you.
Cherie, the tide will be heading out soon and we need to be upon it. Are you with us or no?
I saw the look in her eyes when she glanced in the direction of this fellow magic user, who apparently was a great factor in her young life and had never truly left behind in her growth of imaginings. And in that look I saw, just for a heartbeat, a spark. A gentle, ineffable spark that I instantly, selfishly wanted for myself, and which I knew without the slightest doubt would never be given me. I realized what a fool I'd been. I was positive that if I had said anything of the absurdly impassioned spew that was rattling around inside my head, I would not only sound like a complete idiot, but I would lose whatever shred of respect she might have had for me. What would have been the point of it, really? She was still going to go with Rex Regis. I knew that with certainty. She wanted him. I could tell. And let's face it, it wasn't all that long ago she tried to kill me. And not much longer than that, that she pretty much cursed my name whenever she heard it mentioned. There was no reason to think that sooner or later she wouldn't want to kill me again. Why shouldn't she, really? Everyone else in my life tried to, sooner or later. Really, truly, no matter whom I encountered, eventually one or both of two things would happen. Either that person would die, or that person would try to kill me. What had I done to deserve this fate? Nothing. Be born? That was pretty much it. And what had Cherie done to deserve that fate as well? Nothing. I realized it at that moment with one of those flashes of clarity that one has from time to time. Cherie wasn't going to remain with me. Her eyes were filled with Rex Regis. He was a hero type, a sort I knew all too well. And they had a disgustingly consistent impact on females, which normally wouldn't interest Cherie. But he was obviously an old love, and a mage to boot, and that made him irresistible. But more to the point, if Cherie remained with me, there was every reason to assume that eventually she would join the teeming masses of people who had tried to kill me, or wound up dead, or both. Why wish that on her? But more to the point, if Cherie remained with me, there was every reason to assume that eventually she would join the teeming masses of people who had tried to kill me, or wound up dead, or both. Why wish that on her? Except, I wanted her to say she wanted to remain with me.
You what?
Tell her you love her, or at least like her. Tell her you enjoy her company. Tell her you want time. Tell her that if she leaves you now, you'll likely never see her again, and that's unacceptable. Tell her anything. Go to hell. Anything but that. Mordant, coming with me or staying with Cherie? Mordant cocked his head slightly, and then wrapped his tail around her arm. That was my answer.
Fine.
Something that I hadn't even known was living within me until moments earlier was crushed and died. I turned and walked away without another word to her, feeling sorry for myself in an endeavor to look even more pathetic than I felt. I accentuated my limp as I headed back into the pub. I made my way to Captain Stout. He looked up at me quizzically.
Just me.
I see it's just you. Who else would you be?
I mean that I won't have a lady with me on your boat. It'll just be me booking passage.
Ah, excellent.
He stuck out a hand, which was thick and greasy. I shook it reluctantly and then quietly rubbed it clean on a napkin.
Don't get me wrong. I like the ladies, I do. They certainly have their uses, especially if you need somewhere to dock your dinghy, if you get my drift.
Yes, I get it.
But really, they've no place on a ship. Just cause trouble. Once you're at sea, mark my words, you're better off without him. We'll have a much smoother crossing with just the blokes running the show.
I marked his words. And sometime later, when I was floating in the ocean, fighting what I was certain was imminent drowning, I would have cause to curse them as well. It was some hours later that I brought my meager belongings in a sling over my shoulder down to the Grand Jetty. There was an impressive number of ships docked there of varying sizes and quality. The sky was clear and blue, and the salt of the sea air stung my lungs, but in a refreshing way. I should have felt a sense of exhilaration. Instead, all I had was a distant emptiness. All the way to the gangplank of the ship on which I'd booked passage, I kept glancing over my shoulder. I thought she would come. I thought she would come dashing down the Grand Jetty, waving and calling my name, and Mordant would be flapping behind her like the romantic end of some great novel. There were so many people hustling and bustling about, and a few times I actually thought I did see her. But it was always someone else.
She was a pain in the ass.
I said that to no one except myself. And even I didn't entirely believe me as I turned and made my way up the gangplank. I knew it was the right ship because I saw the name of the vessel. Lark, painted proudly on the side. When the captain told me the ship's name, I asked from where it derived. He looked at me knowingly, as if waiting for my reaction to his next words.
Say it backwards.
Pal.
When he grinned broadly, clearly expecting me to say something more, I forced an expression of comprehension.
Oh, pal. Of course.
I never got any more explanation than that. I boarded the vessel and headed down towards the passenger level. There I encountered my fellow travelers. Two of them were traveling together, and they seemed rather chummy with one another in a way that I considered, frankly, a bit unsettling. The one was a barrel-chested, red-haired barbarian named Farfel. His companion was smaller and rat-faced, dressed in shades of gray, and wore his hair long with some sort of thick gel in it that kept it elaborately wavy. He went by the curious name of Gay Musa. I'd never met a man named Gay. It certainly seemed a convivial moniker. Still, as I noted, the camaraderie between them disturbed me. When I was but a lad, still living in Stroker's Tavern, the sinkhole in which I spent my formative years, I once heard mention of men who preferred to be with other men. In my childish voice, I had piped up, "As well they should. Girls are stupid." This had prompted a round of raucous laughter, which pleased me greatly, until Stroker cuffed me in the ear and told me to mind my own business. Later, I asked my mother about it, and after her face flushed with embarrassment, she explained to me the true significance of such preferences. I was appalled, of course. I simply couldn't comprehend why anyone would choose to do such a thing. My mother, Madeline, did not seem to see it that way.
Strange are the ways of love, apropos. Very curious indeed. It can propel us in directions that all the great wisdom of youth, such as yours, cannot begin to envision. You should not be so quick to judge others.
Why not? If you can't judge others, who can you judge?
Yourself.
I don't see the point in that.
You will.
And eventually I grew up, and she died a violent death. And I had judged myself repeatedly, and had to admit I still didn't quite see the point in it. I encountered a third passenger, who was a rather odd individual, tall, with a distant look, as if he felt he should be somewhere else, with stringy white hair and pale skin. He tended to spend inordinate amounts of time adjusting a gold ring he sported on his right hand. I felt a slight chill looking upon it, for rings and I had not gotten along all that well. He was sharing my cramped quarters, which annoyed me. On the other hand, it certainly was going to be easier with him than the barbarian and his hairstyled companion.
Hello?
He had taken the higher hung hammock and was seated in it, swinging back and forth gently, just shaking his head.
Problem?
He looked at me. Upon closer inspection, I noticed that his skin was peeling. Odd condition.
I don't believe you're here.
Ah.
And I'm not here either.
Ah.
I am simply an anti-hero, thrust into an enforced heroic situation, not of my own making.
I can certainly sympathize. I'm apropos.
I'm completely irrelevant.
It's my damned name. What's yours?
I am called Doubting Tomas.
That was an easy name to believe, although I would have been inclined to switch the letters and make him Touting Dumbass.
All right, I suppose that's marginally better than apropos.
I do not belong in this world.
I know exactly how you feel.
You couldn't possibly. You're of this world.
To be fair, it certainly seems as if you're of it as well.
You know nothing.
One thing I do know. This conversation is over.
Whereupon I turned over in my helmet and promptly fell out as the sling swung out from under me. Without a word, I hauled myself back to my feet, balancing myself on my left as best I could, and pushed myself back into the hammock. It swayed violently once more, but the second time I was able to hang on, albeit ungracefully. I had no idea what to expect in terms of sea travel. I had never been on a boat in my life, and I had always heard that those who were new to such transport could have some trouble with illness. I did not have some trouble. I had an excruciating amount of trouble. We set off immediately. It felt to me as if the entire world was incessantly rocking. I was grateful for the absence of mirrors because, by all accounts, my face was such a repulsive shade of green that rumors began to float around the ship I was some sort of leper, which, for no reason that I could determine, seemed to amuse Doubting Tomas to no end. The hammock swayed with the boat, which did nothing to improve my disposition. I started lying on the floor. That wasn't much better. From time to time, I would emerge upon the deck, lean over the nearest railing, and be sick into the sea. After a while, I ceased vomiting for the simple reason that I had nothing left to vomit, short of heaving up my internal organs. And then, days into the voyage, as I hung over the railing and contemplated simply throwing myself overboard to terminate my misery, I heard the sound of someone with the aid of a staff. I managed to lift my head in time to see a man approaching me. He was tall, with thick red hair, bristling beard, and he was wearing what I recognized as an article of clothing called a kilt. It was red plaid, and he wore a crimson cloak about the shoulders of his thick white shirt, trimmed around the edges with red fur. His staff was ornately carved, with images of what appeared to be dancing goblins cavorting its length.
You got a problem, laddie?
The world seemed to bob and weave mercilessly, even though the water was remarkably calm. I dreaded the notion of our hitting even a mild squall. Gods only knew what it would have done to me. He had a pouch hanging on the front of his kilt, strategically positioned over his manhood. He reached into the pouch. I wasn't sure why, and the gesture was disconcerting because I didn't want to think what he was about to pull out and show me. I was hardly in a position to leave the immediate area, though. A moment later, he extracted a vial with a blue liquid. He looked at it as if to double-check the contents, then strode over to me and extended it.
Drink it.
Now, I have no idea who this fellow was. A total stranger was offering the always suspicious apropos some sort of liquid pulled from the general vicinity of his crotch. For all I knew, it would kill me on the spot. Which is why I took it from him and downed it immediately. That should go to show you just how little affection I had for life at that point. There are few creatures walking the surface of the earth who are more eager to stay alive than me. So if I was so uncaring of life that I was willing to risk throwing it away by swallowing a blue fluid from a total stranger, that alone should tell you a lot. And then suddenly there was an easing of the ache in my stomach, and the world seemed to clear. I blinked several times, scarcely able to believe it.
Good for what ails ye, eh?
He smiled, displaying large, crooked teeth. He patted his pouch, a gesture that I couldn't help but think he'd best not repeat in mixed-gendered company.
Feeling better?
I am, yes, thank you. I wish I'd run into you earlier. I could have saved myself days of suffering. What do you call that stuff?
Just a little home brew. Frankly, he looked like a lad who deserved a break from his suffering. I'm glad I could help.
I'm apropos.
Ronald.
Whereabouts are you from, Ronald?
I like to think of myself as a citizen of the world. It's not where you've been that matters. It's where you wind up. You know what I'm saying?
Oddly enough, I felt I did.
Yes. Will I need more of that stuff?
The dose I gave you should last you about a week. We're supposed to be at sea for 4 weeks, so I'll be happy to supply you with refills.
You're a gift from the gods, Ronald. How much will it cost me?
You needn't worry. We're all travelers together, are we not? Tell you what, are you anxious to repay me?
Now that would be nice.
I lied.
Then join me tonight for a wee game.
A game? I have to warn you, I don't have a lot of money on me, so if it involves gambling of some sort...
Nah, it's nothing like that. I saw we have some other hardy voyagers aboard, and I thought it might be fun to play a wee adventure game.
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Then come down to the galley this evening, and you'll find out. You'll never forget it.
That much he was right about. It appeared that my newfound friend Ronald was a rather convincing sort. Either that, or he had quickly managed to amass a series of debts from the other passengers and con them, on that basis, to join the festivities, because that evening discovered not only myself in the galley, but also the other voyagers whose acquaintance I had earlier made, and my unwilling roommate as well. They were already seated when I arrived. The galley smelled of seawater and slightly rotting food, and it would have been enough to send me into spasms of nausea if it weren't for Ronald's cure-all. So that was enough to remind me that I did owe the red-headed boisterous fellow, and perhaps participating in his game was the least I could do. And as I have abundantly made clear in the past, I always endeavor to do the least I can do. They were seated around a long table that was ordinarily used for meals. None of Captain South's dozen or so crewmen were about. It was just the five of us, with Ronald, who was seated at one end of the table and grinning lopsidedly. I was at the opposite end. Farfel and the gay Musa on the right, Tomas on the left. Every so often, Musa would giggle in a manner that made me want to yank my sword off my back and cleave his head from his shoulders. But Farfel was a brute of a barbarian, and would likely have had something to say on the matter. I had taken to keeping my weapon on my person whenever I wandered about the ship. Although Stout's men seemed innocuous enough, I'd heard far too many tales about unexpected mutinies, or even abrupt attacks by pirates to allow myself to be out of reach of my weapons. The staff was natural enough for me to keep with me at all times. The sword was a hand-and-a-half sword, also known as a bastard sword, given me by one who had every reason to know about such things. Such things meaning bastards.
Expecting problems, apropos?
I restrained myself, partly out of self-control, and partly out of the firm conviction that Farfel would break me in half if I tried it.
I expect nothing, but I anticipate everything.
Solid philosophy.
It was at that point I noticed that Ronald had set something up in front of himself. He had erected three small upright boards, hinged together, and placed them so that they were blocking from our view the table in front of him. He had an assortment of small scrolls in front of himself, and it appeared to me that they were color-coded in some fashion, with a series of blue and yellow and red ribbons designed to make them easier to differentiate at a glance.
What are you doing?
I admit to being somewhat curious about that myself.
Doubting Tomas cast a weary look.
I have no idea why I've allowed myself to be pulled into this. Bad enough I'm forced to travel this twisted road, paved by the sick fantasies of a deranged mind. But now I engage in some sort of nonsensical pursuit purely to provide entertainment value.
Entertainment, aye. Then again, perhaps you learn something about how you handle emergencies and how much risk you're willing to take.
This wasn't going to be difficult for me at all. I handled emergencies by vacating the area as quickly as possible, and the amount of risk I was willing to take was near zero. So, with any luck, I'd be done with this business in no time at all. Ronald pulled 2 6-sided black dice from his sleeve and placed them on the table in front of us. I stared at them. They appeared to be staring back at us, the white dots on their surface, glistening in the dim light. I began to get an uneasy chill at the base of my spine, and I glanced around the table to see if anyone else appeared at all nervous. No one did, which either meant that I was getting myself worked up over nothing, or else they were oblivious of some sort of danger that only I was perceiving.
The name of this game is Tragic Magic.
Sounds like the story of my life, I thought.
Tragic Magic is an adventuring game.
A what?
Farfel raised one bushy eyebrow.
An adventuring game. What happens is, you use these dice.
Ronald pushed forward a number of the parchments.
And the information on these scrolls to create characters for yourselves. We use your own name because where would be the fun in utilizing fake names?
Where indeed.
These characters will have their own individual abilities and character traits. You then send them on an adventure of my devising.
He held up a large scroll that, unlike the others, was tied off with a black ribbon. The recurring black theme was contributing to my overall sense of unease.
The results of your explorations will be determined by each roll of the dice.
This is pointless.
Doubting Tomas and I, for once, agreed.
So we explore this fictitious quest you've fabricated. We kill an evening doing so. What's in it for us, aside from the questionable joy of one another's company?
Oh, did I forget to mention? Just to make it interesting, should ye triumph over the challenges I present you?
He reached into his cloak, which seemed to have become rather voluminous, and a moment later produced a large leather sack. He upended it upon the table, and gold coins spilled out. It was a most impressive sight. I wondered why I was feeling a burning in my lungs, and then came to the belated realization that I'd stopped breathing.
If we win?
How would we split it?
60-60-60?
I decided right then that aside from the fact that I considered the Mooser an abomination, he was a decent enough sort.
Splitting it only becomes a consideration if ye all survive. There are many dangers along the way in Tragic Magic. You cannot be certain your characters will make it through.
We'll take the chance.
Wait. We know what you're putting up. What do we have at stake?
It was a reasonable question, and one that had occurred to me as well.
Why, gentlemen, the pleasure of your company would certainly be enough to satisfy any man, don't you think?
We all looked suspiciously at one another, probably wondering if he was genuinely looking at the motley crew around the table. But then we collectively shrugged. He was obviously something of a loon, but the stakes he was putting up were sane enough, and there seemed no harm in going along with it. Following his instructions and a dizzying set of rules, we created characters out of paper and dice rolls. The Mooser reconfigured himself as a thief. Farfel became a bulging barbarian. Neither characterization seemed all that much of a stretch. Doubting Tomas became a cleric, a holy man wielding magic powers. And I, much to my annoyance, found myself designated as a jackanapes.
You mean a clown?
A jester. You provide amusement for the crew of hardy adventurers.
Ugh.
Long-time listeners to my adventures will readily comprehend why this new status was anathema to me. I almost walked out of the game right then and there. Even the consistently dour Tomas thought it was a highly amusing circumstance. The adventure began innocuously enough. I had to admit, Ronald certainly had a way of evoking scene and mood.
The tale begins as our four adventurers, strangers to one another, have all sought shelter in a tavern one cold winter's night. They have all settled in for the night when suddenly the door flies open and a dying man stumbles into the pub. As he falls to the floor, they notice he is grasping what appears to be a map, with an X marking a spot deep within some place called the Foreboding Mountains. A dying warning escapes the dying man's lips as he takes his final breath. Failure to complete my mission could result in the end of the world as we knew it. Now, you must decide. How shall you proceed on your quest?
Don't go. It was madness. We're in a warm pub on a cold night. What possible reason is there to go out and risk our necks just to save the world? What, after all, has the world ever done for me?
My cohorts proceeded on an assumption that I, as Jackanapes, was trying to provide some levity. The hell I was. Even in a fictitious setting, the allure of drink and safety was always preferable to deprivation and danger, but they didn't see it that way.
Let's explore the village and see what there is to help on our mission. We'll need supplies before we proceed.
We then spent time wandering about the make-believe village and acquiring make-believe armaments, potions, supplies, etc., using make-believe money. I thought it was all make-believe bullshit by that point, but the others seemed genuinely caught up in the mechanics of the fictitious adventure. The group of us set out on our journey, and throughout our first encounters, we had a fairly easy time of it. We would encounter random threats.
You've encountered a giant!
Attack!
Damage minus 12. Kill.
At those times, we would develop strategies, and the roll of the dice would tell us how successful we were.
Small dragon attacks!
Cast spell.
Damage minus 10.
We were consistently able to navigate our way past the assorted dangers, and even I was finding some degree of amusement in the entire process. Having encountered my share of quest-related horrors, an impressive accomplishment, considering my near-obsessive aversion to quests. There was definitely some entertainment in chancing upon threats to life and limb without any of our lives or limbs actually being jeopardized. Still, whenever those dice came down, I felt, I didn't know what. Worried? Jumpy? A sensation that we were fish within a net and we didn't even realize it because the net hadn't been drawn closed yet? Others didn't notice or care. They became more boisterous, more adventurous as matters progressed. And over it all, Ronald sat there with a wide grin, watching hawkishly. We had navigated our way through an assortment of hazards.
Congratulations, you're now within the Foreboding Mountains.
I think maybe we should leave.
Naturally, no one paid me any heed.
You are faced with two branching forks.
Ronald, with a gleam in his eyes, was leaning forward, wide-shouldered, hunched like a gargoyle, or perhaps a predatory bird about to pounce.
Both are illuminated by flickering torches. There is an inscription on the wall just outside the left path.
I read it.
It's written in a runic. It says, "Do not even think for a moment about going this way, or you will die."
That's the way we'll go, then.
It says not to. It says we shouldn't even think about it.
Obviously, they're trying to throw us off the scent.
That's one interpretation. The other is that someone took the time to warn us that we'll die if we go that way.
It seems to me damn rude to ignore it if a person went to so much trouble.
Apropos, it's just a game. What's the worst that can happen?
Every time I've asked myself that, I invariably find out, and it's usually worse than I could have possibly imagined.
Nonsense. We enter the left branch. We are not put off by the sign.
Who is in the lead?
Quaffle hesitated, clearly not expecting the question.
I will take the lead, since I will be able to read any signs that present themselves.
It was Doubting Tomas who spoke up, far more into the game than I would have credited. I looked around nervously. The ship was beginning to rock a bit more than before. I was more grateful than ever for the medication that Ronald had provided me. But that gratitude and distant sense of relief was overwhelmed by an even greater sense of foreboding.
The cleric takes the lead.
Wait! Ronald turned and fixed me with a dark-eyed stare.
The cleric takes the lead. You proceed down the hallway. There is a thick mist in the air. Torches continue to flicker on either side. Just ahead of you, there is a large door made of solid stone.
Doesn't have a lock?
Aye, inset into the door, but there is no sign of a key.
Not a problem. The thief comes forward and produces his lockpicks. He proceeds to work on the lock.
The torches grow brighter.
I could see it so clearly in my mind. The four of us in this scenario, so vividly that it was as if I was standing right there. The torches went higher still.
We're leaving.
The hell we are!
We've got to get out of here. This thing stinks of a trap.
I'm still working on the lock.
Roll the dice. A roll over 8 means the door unlocks.
Don't touch the Musa.
The Musa looked at me as if I were insane. His expression was filled with disdain. His hair was filled with gel.
Gods, you really are quite the coward, aren't you?
A 4 and a 2 stared up at us.
Bad luck.
The room was illuminated through the solitary porthole.
The torches respond to the attempted intrusion.
They what?
And then he ignited. His hair went up, and leaping to his feet, he batted his hands furiously at his head.
Barbo, help me! Help me!
The alarmed barbarian upended his drink on the moose's head. It made no difference. The flames were spreading and his entire head was engulfed. The smell was horrific. Tomas sat there disbelieving. One had to admire his consistency. Ronald didn't budge from his place. Desperately, Farfel yanked off his cloak and threw it over the moose's head in an attempt to smother the flame. No good. It was as if the flame didn't need air to survive, as if it was feeding off some completely different source. It engulfed the entirety of the Musa and the cloak as well. The screams had ceased, probably because his vocal cords had melted, but there was still violent shaking and twitching as the Musa fell to the floor. And suddenly an aura of glowing light lifted from the Musa. It seemed to have form and substance, and yet was without either. It pulled free from the Musa, mercifully it seemed, for that finally caused his body to cease its trembling. Then the pure, unsullied essence leaped through the air and into Ronald. His eyes glowed with an inner light, and he licked his lips as if savoring some great delicacy as the aura suffused into his very being. Within moments it faded, and Ronald looked more vibrant, more powerful than he had before. The flames appeared to consume themselves, and in seconds, they were gone. What was left was a smoldering pile of cooked meat that didn't look vaguely human. A door with a few tattered pieces of cloth that had somehow managed to avoid being scorched.
You right bastard!
Farfel didn't have a sword, but he didn't need one. He bore a dagger that was the size of a man's forearm, and he yanked it from his belt in preparation for leaping at Ronald.
Sit down, barbarian.
I'll carve you up!
Sit down!
The dagger slipped from Farfel's suddenly nerveless fingers, and he flopped down into his chair. His face went beet red, and he strained mightily to stand, but couldn't do so.
I am the magic maestro here, the runner of this game, the controller of your destinies. To be the MM of a game of tragic magic is to be the supreme being. So I'll thank you to continue the evening's entertainment.
Entertainment? A man is dead! My man is dead!
I found that entertaining.
This isn't happening. I refuse to believe. None of this is real. It's all a fantasy that I'll be awakening from just about at any time.
Shut up, Tomas. Who are you?
I am Ronald McDonald!
As if matters weren't sufficiently melodramatic.
Ronald McDonald, of the Clan McDonald?
Aye, the same. You've heard of me.
I haven't.
I have. I just didn't believe a word of it.
I reached over and cuffed Tomas on the side of the head.
Ah! Why did you do that?
It just seemed like the thing to do. I turned to Farfel, who looked as if a dozen emotions were warring within him at once.
McDonald is a weaver I've heard tell of, back when I was an innkeeper in a far-off land. His name is mentioned in whispers, lest saying it too loudly summon him.
Really? And what do the whispers say?
They say you're insane. They say you seek ways to control men's destinies. They say that normal human sustenance is no longer sufficient for you, and that you consume your victim's vitality at the cusp of their deaths.
Anything else?
Yes, that you're a hell of a dancer, but I never place much stock in that.
Let's rush him! He can't withstand a charge from all of us!
Fine idea. You first.
I was trying to rise from the chair, but having no luck, I was rooted to the spot.
Wait, this isn't happening. This isn't happening. This isn't happening. This isn't happening.
You have submitted yourself to my authority as magic maestro. By the laws of this game, you're bound to me, and the game must be seen through to the end.
And what constitutes the end?
Until you lose.
Which was pretty much the answer I'd suspected.
And if we win?
Oh, ho, 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 I think the dice will see that doesn't happen. But you never know. They can be capricious.
Then, as if further discussion was pointless, which it probably was, Ronald McDonald, of the Clan McDonald, looked back down at the adventure he was charting.
The entire hallway in front of you is aflame.
We back up and head for the exit.
Bad news. A monstrous cave troll is standing between ye and the exit. He advances on ye. He looks hungry. The chances are that he will devour ye. However, he's a relatively young troll and will likely be satisfied with one of ye.
We toss him the cleric.
The hell you do!
Tomas lunged for the dice, but Farfel scooped them up and dropped them as if they were red hot. The dice skidded across the table and came up double six.
The move works.
No, it doesn't work!
Suddenly, the front of Tomas's body seemed to explode, as if he was being ripped open by a great unseen force. I ducked to avoid the hurtling organs that splattered just above me. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a glow. And then the unbelieving Tomas was gone. His essence ripped from his body with as much force as his body was ripped from itself.
The monstrous cave troll chokes on the cleric as pieces of him lodge in its throat, and it dies.
We race for the exit!
But it falls in front of the exit, blocking your way out with its sheer bulk. It's too heavy for you to lift.
I take out my sword of power and start hacking at it. Farfel kept glancing nervously at the charred remains of the Musa. He looked as if he wanted to start sobbing, but was too afraid to do even that.
Your sword
deflects off it.
I hit it again!
Your sword bounces away once more. There is, however, another door down at the opposite end. It appears to be open.
I hit the ogre with my sword.
Ronald appeared to be getting annoyed, and I immediately realized why. Farfel had apparently discovered a move he could make that was fairly harmless. If he made no further move in the game, then he would be impervious to anything bad happening to him. He would hack the unyielding ogre from now until doomsday for all he cared. Meantime, sooner or later, someone who wasn't a participant in this cursed game would enter the room and, with any luck, beat Ronald senseless. I would have been howling for help the entire time, but the sounds of the storm outside was too vicious. I knew it would have been a waste of effort.
The blade bounces off.
I hit the ogre with my sword.
Ronald sat back in his chair for a moment, appearing to consider the situation. Then he shrugged.
Very well. Roll the dice.
They clattered across the table and came up 2 and a 3.
All right. Your sword blade bounces off the ogre and stabs you through the heart.
Barfel opened his mouth to protest, but blood began to pour out. His eyes widened. He clutched at his chest. There was more blood oozing between his fingers. His eyes shone with anger and confusion. And then, with one final despondent glance in the direction of the Moosa, he keeled over. Just before Farfel hit the floor once again, there was that glorious glow of light that, under other circumstances, I would have gazed upon with wonder. Now it simply horrified me, as the essence of Farfel leaped across the table and into the receptive Ronald. Ronald's head lolled for a few moments, rubbing his chest. Then he looked at me.
You're obviously full. We can continue this later, I'm sure.
The door awaits you.
Yes, I'm sure it does, and don't think I'm not anxious to get myself killed for your dining and dancing pleasure. But the fact is, I was never much for adventures to begin with. So, if it's all the same to you, I'd just as soon shut this one down.
Tell you what, I'll make it easy for you. You suddenly find yourself magically transported through the door into the adjoining chamber. There before you, you see a great flaming sword hanging in the middle of the room, suspended by an invisible force.
And you must think I'd be a great flaming idiot for even considering getting anywhere near it.
You are going to reach for the sword. Roll the dice to see if you're able to command it.
I still couldn't rise out of my chair. I tried to reach around to yank my sword from its scabbard in the hope that I could fling it at him, perhaps impale him. But my arm wouldn't move.
You think to kill me?
He smiled, as if able to read my mind, which for all I knew he could.
It doesn't end that easily, apropos. I am the magic maestro. I control your destiny.
Something in the way he said that, the incredible smugness, overcame my blinding fear and ignited my rage, which was always bubbling just beneath the surface anyway.
The hell you do! I'd have lived a long and happy life if I didn't have a destiny of any sort. Instead, I've spent my entire existence with different people telling me I have a great destiny that I'm supposed to live up to. A destiny I want no part of, thank you very much. But this much I know. I'll be damned if I give a bullying, soul-sucking lunatic like you command over whatever destiny my future holds. Great or not, you control my destiny? Gods supposedly control man's destinies, and I've killed a god or two in my time. So don't think you can sit there all menacing and magical and get me to knuckle under to your parlor tricks.
Roll the dice.
You roll the bloody dice.
I lunged, sweeping my hand back as if to knock them toward him, and he flinched. His face was still a mask of foreboding, but for a heartbeat, there was a look of concern in his eyes as he shrank back from even the prospect of the accursed dice coming his way. That was when I realized. I thought about how he had never actually touched the dice. He had upended them onto the table from their pouch. A desperate thought flashed through my mind, and apparently it did so at the exact same moment in Ronald's. We both grabbed our respective ends of the table and tried to upend it, angle it so that we were in the superior position, and the downward slope of the table would send the dice clattering toward the other. The power in my arms, thanks to a lifetime of hauling myself around by them to compensate for my lame leg, is not to be underestimated. He shoved the end of the table upward, and the dice tumbled toward me. I pushed forward, shoved back, briefly shifting the tilt so the dice began to roll the other way. I tried to shove the table over so the accursed things would fall to the floor. It didn't work. They clung to the table with an uncanny life of their own, which I was beginning to suspect they truly did possess. We tried with all our respective might to bring ruin upon the other. The dice rolled one way and then the other as we jockeyed for position, and the rocking of the boat itself didn't help matters. The mug of mead I'd been drinking from overturned, falling against my chest and sending foaming liquid cascading into my lap. I jumped from the unexpected coldness. Ronald thrust upward with all his strength, and the dice tumbled right toward me. There was no way I was going to be able to avoid them. Seized with a final burst of desperation, I grabbed the mug and brought it up to the table level. The poisonous dice tumbled into the mug without coming into physical contact with my person. For an instant, Ronald hadn't seen what happened and tried to move the table so he could get a better view. Grabbing the opportunity, I slammed the table forward. The far end struck him full in the face.
Oh, you dirty bumpot!
And you can choke on your flaming death sword!
I swung the mug around and let the dice fly. For my first roll of the evening, luck was with me, for Ronald opened his mouth wide to shout something at me. And the dice flew straight in as if they had eyes. Snake eyes.
The flaming sword of doom doesn't like you.
He clutched at his throat, at his chest, as whatever dark magic the dice possessed worked its way and will through him. He began to tremble and toss about, and suddenly I could stand once more, which I did so forcefully, and I overbalanced the chair and fell backwards out of it. I scrambled to my feet best I could, clutching my staff. Ronald fell back against the bulkhead, trembling, energy appearing to build up from within him, smoke rising from his open mouth, from his ears. His eyes began to smolder, and jets of flame suddenly ripped from them. It was then that I realized the significant problem. When others had rolled the dice, whatever horrific circumstances had hit them had struck from without and worked its way in. With Ronald, it was going from the inside out. The table was sideways on the floor. I threw myself behind it. Just as Ronald exploded with deafening force, the game documents, the partition he used, all went up instantly. The incredible power of the energies released slammed the table back against me, and me in turn against the far wall. I heard a massive roaring and thought it was coming from within my head. Then the smell of salt and spray was overwhelming, and I peeped out from behind my table just in time to see a sight that caused my heart to sink somewhere into my boots. Ronald was gone. So was a good chunk of the boat. Where he'd been standing and exploded, there was now a vast gaping hole, and seawater was rushing in with the eagerness of a group of sellswords at a virgin's convention. There was no way out. The water was gushing everywhere, barreling up the steps leading to the upper decks. I did the only thing I could think of. I clutched onto the table for dear life, lying flat on my staff to hold it in position as best I could. Seconds later, there was water everywhere. I took a deep breath, wondering how many days I could hold it. And then I was yanked out of the room holding on desperately, I clutched my first lover with less tenacity than I did that large piece of wood.